The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and I look forward to another year of bringing you the leaders of the world of philanthropy and social enterprise. And we'll begin with one of the most notable and thoughtful of those leaders. She is Jean Case, the president of the Case Foundation, which she started with her husband, Steve, after their days at AOL. And her new book came out just this past week. It's titled Be Fearless, Five Principles for a Life of Breakthroughs and Purpose. And when you examine transformational change, she says, they all begin pretty much in the same way.
It does start with making a big bet, rejecting incremental change, and really trying to embrace a very big idea. It is constant, no matter where you look, no matter where in the world, no matter what sector you're looking at, that it starts with a big idea, a truly big bet.
And then I will be joined by Becky Straw, the co-founder and CEO of The Adventure Project. She'll tell us what the mission of the organization is.
We're focused on helping giving people who live on less than $2 a day job training so that they can move themselves out of poverty. The key is that the job training is around helping the community. So that's everything from training people to be well mechanics or healthcare workers or helping farmers gain access to irrigation. It's what are those smart interventions that's going to lift that family out of poverty so that they can thrive.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, January 13th. World Bank Group President Jim Yong Kim has announced that he will step down from his position on February 1 after more than 6 years at the helm of the Multilateral Global Development Organization. At the end of last year, California gave final approval for new building codes that will require every new home built in the state to come equipped with rooftop solar or source power from a community solar array starting in 2020. Composer, lyricist, and performer Lin-Manuel Miranda and his family have announced the creation of a first-of-its-kind scholarship at Rhode Island College to champion first-generation and underrepresented students in the performing arts. Deaths from cancer dropped 27% over a quarter century, meaning an estimated 2.6 million fewer people died of the disease during that period, according to a new report from researchers at the American Cancer Society. Children's Home Society of South Dakota in Sioux Falls has announced a $55 million gift from philanthropist T. Denny Sanford in support of its services for children and adults in need. This is the largest one-time gift in the nonprofit's 125-year history. And finally, a study conducted by researchers at Villanova University and the University of Wisconsin found that charities earning a seal of transparency from the nonprofit GuideStar gained an average of 53% more contributions 1 year later. People sure want to know where their money is going. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Jean Case right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and a path to success. 85% of Year Up alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support transformative opportunities for young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
The influence that leaders from the tech sector have had on the world of philanthropy over the past two decades has been profound. The creation of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the year 2000 was certainly a pivotal moment in that regard. But several years before that, in 1997 to be precise, this influence started to be realized when Steve and Jean Case of AOL, America Online, founded the Case Foundation. And it's a great pleasure to have with us this evening Jean Case, the CEO of the foundation and the author of a fabulous new book, Be Fearless, Five Principles for a Life of Breakthroughs and Purpose. Good evening, Jean, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, good evening, Denver. I've really been looking forward to this time with you.
Likewise. You and your husband were digital pioneers, and I can recall how mission-centric AOL was in those early days. Share with us with the journey from there to starting the Case Foundation some 21 years ago.
Sure. Well, for those who are maybe not as familiar because they're too young with the mission of AOL, and back in those days, we were really about building the Internet revolution. But it was about democratizing access to ideas and information and communication and really empowering people. We found success at one time. AOL carried 50% of the nation's Internet traffic.
Wow.
So we saw firsthand the power to use resources to empower others. And I think we always knew that if resources came our way, we would want to share them with the world and continue to use them to empower others.
Mm-hmm. And I find the foundation expresses its theory of change with wonderful clarity. And let's touch on a few of those elements if we can. One of them would be inclusive entrepreneurship, and the data around that is quite startling. So taking venture capital as an example, Gene, how is that distributed across the United States?
Well, it's really quite alarming to see the consolidation of venture capital today, and it's unprecedented in our nation. I'll give you some data to get started. Last year, 90% of venture capital went to firms founded by men, leaving only 10% available to women. But the capital itself was only 2% that went to women. It was 10% of the deals, but 2% of the capital. Only 1% flowed to African-American founders. And perhaps most alarming, 78% of the capital went to just three places in the nation, California, New York, and Massachusetts.
47 states fighting over the other 22%.
Absolutely. So in some cases, a state might get all year what a Silicon Valley firm could get in a week.
Well, let's take that last one then. You have always believed that the people closest to the problem are the one closest to the solution. So if venture capital is targeted towards the middle of America, as opposed to the two coasts that you just mentioned, what pockets of innovation do you see springing up?
Oh, sure. Well, let's just think about ag tech, for instance. Food as another example. You know, think about some of the needs that we have in this planet to look at our land and to look at our food and to look at our agriculture. Where is that expertise in the nation? It is in our nation's heartland. So that's one example of a sector that we see so much promise in terms of new innovations, but we need to make sure that we bring mentors and capital and what we call that jet fuel to allow some of these new innovations to grow.
Yeah, and another example I think you cited was New Orleans and education, correct?
Absolutely. A lot of people don't know it, but after Hurricane Katrina, there was a flood of about 1,000 Teach for America young people who went down there in the schools. And what you talked about, Denver, is spot on. They saw problems and they came up with solutions, many of them in the form of new companies in what we call ed tech or education technology. So it's become a real hub. Nashville's become a real hub for healthcare. So in certain pockets, and if we look at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we tend to think of it as an old steel town. But today, it has really become a hub for both robotics and AI. A lot of the driverless car technology that Uber and Ford and others are taking forward, they're doing so right there in Pittsburgh.
Carnegie Mellon, that's
absolutely
right. So another thing that you've been a pioneer in has been impact investing. In fact, you may have started impact investing before anybody had coined the term impact investing.
Well, not exactly. What I would say is we were doing impact investing before we knew there was a term for it. Let's put it that way.
There you go.
It was actually a team that came together and coined the phrase. But yes, we've been deeply engaged in impact investing for a long time. And there, of course, we're talking about financial investments that provide both a financial return but also a social return. And we're excited by the growing momentum in the space.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see us along that journey right now in terms of the arc of impact investing?
Yeah, well, I feel really good about it. I mean, we're at a point where hundreds of billions of dollars are going into it. It doubled over the last year. I just came back from Paris with a group of high net worth individuals who were coming together to look at impact investing opportunities. And really everywhere I go, last summer I was in Seoul, Korea with a group of Asian investors. But around the world and here in America, we're seeing tremendous traction and momentum in the movement.
Mm-hmm. Another area of focus for the foundation has been around civic engagement. In fact, I remember one of your campaigns, get in the arena.
Exactly.
Are we beginning to see that in a more pronounced way now?
You know, I think we are. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about this when we talk about the book. But I do think people look around at their world today and they feel a passionate need to make a difference. I think this next generation, which we've followed through research for the last decade, touched over 100,000 of them in terms of getting their views and their insights insights around social good. Look, like all young generations, they're idealistic.
Mm-hmm.
What's different about this generation is they're turning their idealism really into action. And by the way, voting. We were very, very encouraged to see the degree of voting that took place among the next generation in these recent midterms we had.
One last thing about the foundation itself. From all the initiatives that you've created, developed, been part of, is there anyone that you're particularly excited or proud or fond of?
So, Denver, they're all like my children. What I will say, though, is we try to capture what we do by saying we invest in people and ideas that can change the world. And we've been so privileged to find and fund and spotlight great people all over the world doing extraordinary things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I so much enjoyed reading your book. Let's turn our attention to that, where you lay out the five principles of what it takes to be fearless. And, you know, one of the things I loved about the book is that I actually remember the five principles. And so often when I read books, I'm always going back to find out what the two or the six or the eight principles are. These things are so natural.
Great.
That they stick with your mind. And I'm going to walk through each one of them and have you talk about them, if you would, starting with big bets, make big bets, and make history. Now, sounds like incrementalism isn't going to take us to where we need to go. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, we should point out that those principles were developed as part of work we did several years back at the Case Foundation, using research and led by some social scientists to look around and look back and say, hey, lots of people chase big ideas and transformational things. Why do some break out and others don't?
Mm-hmm.
And what we found, of course, were these five principles that I think we're going to walk through. It does start with making a big bet, rejecting incremental change and really trying to embrace a very big idea. It is constant no matter where you look, no matter where in the world, no matter what sector you're looking at, that it starts with a big idea, a truly big bet.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of those big bets was around malaria. And you cite that in the book. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, malaria is a great story. You know, there's a great leader here in New York, Ray Chambers.
Fantastic guy.
Yeah, fantastic guy who really got deeply engaged in malaria. He had this unbelievably successful career as an investor and really was storied. MBA students learn about his success on that front. But then kind of took a right turn in life and said, now I really want to spend the rest of my time giving away what I've earned. And so he jumped into malaria, really knowing nothing about it. He was on a trip to Africa, and he observed some children in a hospital, and he said, oh, they're all sleeping. And someone said, no, they're in malaria coma. I think that was a day that changed the rest of his life, because he committed to bringing together a terrific collaboration to focus on malaria. And the story in a nutshell, Denver, I think, is that there were lots of people out there doing different things for malaria. And if you might have gone to someone making a bed net and say, what are you doing? They would have said, well, I'm making a bed net for malaria. After Ray pulled this collaboration together around a big idea, which is eradicate malaria off the planet, you go to those people today and they say, you say, what are you doing? And they say, I'm helping to eradicate malaria from the planet.
Yeah.
So it's a great model. And of course, you know, the rollback of malaria across the areas that he has focused on has just been extraordinary. In some countries, as much as an 80% reduction.
Yeah, it's amazing how big bets just energize people.
No question.
Who are kind of just walking through their paces, but then all of a sudden they get excited and they become superhuman in some ways.
Right. Well, if you think about it, there's almost a physical analogy to it that I think about, which is we're marching forward, but wait, now suddenly we're linked arms. We're marching together toward a common vision and a really big idea. And I think that does galvanize and coalesce people in a powerful way.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes around this is somebody said that if you are having trouble rolling a small rock up a hill, the thing to do is go find a bigger rock. Because the way you think changes and the energy you have to push changes as well.
Very interesting.
The second principle is be bold, take risks. And I'm intrigued how that word risk is almost never used in the sector. So I'm so glad, Gene, that you have brought up the R word. How do you need to look at this if you're going to be a fearless leader?
You know, it's very funny because I spend time across all sectors. And while we may be quick to understand that maybe the nonprofit or philanthropy sector is a little less comfortable with risk, it turns out across sectors, people are uncomfortable with risk. And so one of the things that I point out in the book is, what if we look at risk-taking as R&D? We understand that to do transformational things in science and in medicine and in technology, we have to deploy an R&D strategy and usually a budget along with it as well of time or money. And so really, if we think about risk along the lines of research and development in our own lives, in our own organization, and try new things, it becomes a little less scary. That risk word does scare people. But the bottom line is, you can't do new things. You can't break through with innovations without taking significant risk.
And I love that concept of R&D, because when you change the language, it just has a completely different connotation.
It really does.
To what you're doing.
It really does.
And you feel good about, I'm doing some R&D.
Yeah.
I'm not risking donors' money.
And, you know, one of the quotes I put in the book was Steve Jobs, because, you know, he said he's heard from people who say they don't have R&D budgets, so how are they supposed to compete in this world? And he points out that a lot of it comes down to a passionate team and really a point of view about, we're going to try some things and we're going to keep going even if we fail along the way.
The third principle is to make failure matter. And while failure is celebrated in Silicon Valley, or if it's not celebrated, at least it's accepted as a necessary part of the process, it's not so much the case in the social sector, where the problems are even more daunting. What do you think the reason for that is?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and we think more broadly about the social sector, which could be comprised of, let's say, the government or the public sector,
mm-hmm.
philanthropy, and nonprofits. And in all those three cases, the money that they're deploying often comes from someone else, right? In the case of the government, it's taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of philanthropy, sometimes you're shepherding someone's money who lived 100 years ago. In nonprofits, of course, you want to keep your donors pleased. So I think, without intention, what that has led to is a reluctance to talk about what isn't working or where there was failure. What I love is, I think there is a new breed of philanthropists and donors who encourage their organizations and even their governments to say, try some crazy things and let's see where we can go. You know, I think that it was a message we first devised thinking that it was really aimed at the social sector, because we had come out of technology where we understood the importance of taking risks to break through. But it turns out, as I said earlier, really all sectors need this message. Big companies, as they get more comfortable and established, it's too easy for them not to want to take a risk, to put all of that at risk. So surprisingly to us, the message of Be Fearless more broadly has resonated across sectors.
Mm-hmm. And I think also sometimes is that we tend to underestimate donors. Organizations are afraid how donors are going to react if they fail. But they're actually a little bit more intelligent than that. They understand that we're going to make some great change. So this is almost an assumption, which is really not always true.
Right. And it goes back a little bit to that big bet, or let's say big
mm-hmm.
idea, because I think if you bring the donor in and you say, we're going to try something, but we're trying it towards achieving something really great, that we don't see how we can get there without taking some risks, will you back us? I think that kind of kumbaya moment between the donor and the one receiving the funds is important and can provide air cover then when failure does happen.
Well, when you talk about make failure matter, you actually have experienced that firsthand. With a water initiative you did in sub-Saharan Africa. Tell us that story. It's a great story.
Sure. Well, first of all, Denver, I need to make clear that isn't my only failure story, as you might imagine, but that's certainly one
of your more prominent ones,
I highlighted in the book, and it's very public. Yeah, so we introduced a very large initiative called Play Pumps, and it was this really innovative technology that used a children's merry-go-round, kind of like a windmill on the ground, if you think about it, to pump clean water.
Mm-hmm.
We put a big collaboration together. We launched it at the Clinton Global Initiative with President Clinton to my right and First Lady Laura Bush to my left.
Oh boy.
So it was very high profile. We brought a number of partners in. And as we began to deploy across 10 sub-Saharan African countries, we started to get some feedback from the field that there were some issues here, some issues over there. We did what any organization or initiative would do. And, you know, we spent about a year or two trying to course correct. And finally, it became clear it wasn't working and we had a choice to make. And again, I talk about this in the book. And of course, we were tempted to say, can't we just sweep that thing under the rug and not talk about it?
Oh, yeah.
But we knew what we had to do. And so in the end, we did decide to come clean. I wrote a very public blog called The Painful Acknowledgement of Coming Up Short. And frankly, that was probably where our Be Fearless work was born, even though we didn't know it at the time. It was, because what I saw immediately was my peers across all sectors saying, Thank you for acknowledging failure. It doesn't happen enough. And of course, we didn't just shut it down. We pivoted and found a better way forward. But I think it was particularly the public acknowledgement that was rare. And then we started these things called fail fests, mm-hmm. where we would get groups together and we would share stories of failure, not to celebrate them at all, but to really use them as teachable moments. And, you know, some of the failures that stories that others have boldly shared with me have helped me be better as I take on other things because I can learn from them.
I can just picture you trying to hit send after you wrote that blog.
Boy.
I mean, I can see the hand shaking.
No question.
Like, pull the push down.
Yeah, really one of the hardest send buttons I've ever had.
for sure. The fourth principle is reach beyond your bubble. So I guess being firmly planted in your comfort zone is no way to be fearless. Talk to that.
That's exactly right. Another way that we describe that is the importance of building unlikely collaborations and partnerships. You know, it's surprising, but when you look back at things that have broken through, it actually is because people were able to stop and say, I don't have everything it takes to take this big idea forward. I need people unlike me with complementary skills, perspectives, and backgrounds. That's a really important part of the secret sauce of transformation. So, yes, it's a very important principle, and we see this play out in big ways.
Yeah. In fact, at the Case Foundation, you've really made cross-sector collaboration something that everybody has to do.
We do. So most of our major initiatives, if not all, have had a nonprofit partner, a public sector partner, and a corporate or business partner as well. And it's specifically because each one brings a different expertise or capability that we don't necessarily have and then helps us be able to aim much bigger and broader in our efforts.
One of the examples in the book you cite is the Four Freedoms Fund. Speak to that.
Well, you know, it's an example of a lot of different things that we've done through time. I think when we look back at the things that have been most effective, it's because we can actually pinpoint how different it was than something that we were familiar with or an expertise that we had.
Mm-hmm. And my favorite of your five principles is the final one, and that is let urgency conquer fear. In fact, you quote Martin Luther King in the book talking about the fierce urgency of now. Talk a little bit about
that. Boy, that's right. And, you know, I really think about that in this day. I think many people are walking around feeling the fierce urgency of now. I think they see division. I think they see, in many cases, fear gripping communities. And, you know, this sense of urgency that we feel can sometimes get us out of our comfort zones enough because it's pushing us. It's an urgency we feel to maybe do something that in normal course and speed, we wouldn't be able to dig deep and really go take that risk.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the reasons I think I like this one so much, this principle, is that with the other four, I'm thinking about them. But when I have urgency, my body gets involved.
That's your action point.
Absolutely. And when my body gets involved and I'm not thinking too much, things just happen, whereas there's a lot that can go on upstairs in your head, which will allow me to rationalize it or procrastinate it. But urgency, when your body is engaged, things begin to happen.
Yeah, and, you know, we haven't talked about it, but although we do talk about the principles in the book, and they're the basis of the book, as you know, Denver, they really are brought out through storytelling, great stories of people who have lived these principles in a meaningful way. And in urgency, we're used to, for instance, on a battlefield or in a natural disaster, people do extraordinary things, and that is urgency really pushing them forward. But I also try to bring some examples forward of ordinary people who've done extraordinary things because they felt that deep sense of urgency in the moment.
Well, give us an example of one of those.
Sure. Well, Corrie Ten Boom is an unlikely hero, I think, in many respects. A woman who, in her 50s, she was single and living with her father above a watchmaking shop in Holland when she witnessed a terrible act. It was the late 30s when the Nazis were moving across Europe, and she witnessed a Jewish neighbor being led out of his house and held at gunpoint. She was so horrified, she ran across the street and grabbed him. The soldiers had gone into the house to ransack it. She grabbed him and brought him into the shop. And that began for her a fearless life as a soldier in the resistance army against the Nazis. She ended up saving hundreds of Jews. She went to a concentration camp herself and suffered for her actions. And when she was finally released, she went right back to that same fearless resistance work that she had done before. But I'm quite certain if that urgent moment hadn't hit her, it might have been different for her to find the boldness to do some extraordinary things.
You're absolutely right. And you also have admired the fearlessness of Betty Ford. Why
yes.
so?
Well, you know, I think Betty Ford's fearlessness isn't acknowledged enough.
I agree with you.
A couple of ways. First of all, as many people might know, she developed breast cancer when she was first lady. And I'm a breast cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we don't remember it, but it wasn't talked about. Remember, it has the word breast in it. My goodness. We don't talk about that.
We'll have to blip this.
But she was very transparent about what she had gone through. And really, I think many people give her credit for the way, you know, routine screens and scans are adopted today and more women go for them because it was put on the table as a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Women in many cases didn't know what to do. The second reason is because of her own battle with addictions. You know, she did have addictions and substance abuse, both alcohol and drugs. And, you know, her family boldly confronted her with it. And she boldly took action. And then, of course, out of that was born the Betty Ford Center, which is perhaps one of the best-known rehabilitation centers in the nation. And over 100,000 people have received care through the Betty Ford Center since that time. But when you think about those two things, right, something involving that word breast,
yeah.
but also really sort of what can be otherwise shame and hiding of an addiction problem, because of her transparency, she's been able to affect the lives of many, many people.
That's a great point. Two taboo issues that
yes.
she really shined a bright light on.
Exactly.
And momentum is carried forward. And speaking of family, there's been an issue close to your family, and that has to do with Accelerate Brain Cancer Cure. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, that's an organization we co-founded as a family with my late brother and my sister-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
He developed brain cancer, a glioblastoma, at the age of 41, and it was very clear that, you know, there was not very much survivability of that cancer at the time. So as lay people, we began to ask a bunch of questions. He was an amazing leader himself. And so we decided, well, maybe there's an opportunity to try to accelerate therapies for that cancer. At the time, the therapies being used had been used for 20 years. There was no innovation. So we brought a large collaborative together, and I'm really grateful to say that survivability has really extended and many new therapies have been brought into the field in the last 20 years or so.
Well, Be Fearless is certainly not just a book. It's a movement and something that you have championed for such a long time now. It's probably almost part of you.
Definitely.
Yeah. But now that the book is here, what are some of the things you're going to do to try to activate this movement so people, in fact, do become fearless?
Well, our hope is that in laying out the principles, but honestly, in using these inspirational stories of what I really do believe people will see as ordinary people, maybe just like themselves, who dug deep, applied the principles, and ended up doing extraordinary things. So we hope it's a clarion call. We think it is a good antidote to the fear and sort of some of the discouragement that people feel out there, and hopefully just an inspiration for people to take whatever their big idea or solution that they see they can be part of to take that forward.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. When we look at some of these luminaries, we say to ourselves, well, I'm not like that. But when you see these everyday people, it's much easier to see ourselves in that person.
That's right.
And therefore say, well, maybe me too. And it gives you the courage and the inspiration to move ahead.
Right. And I will say, Denver, you know, part of the reason I just wove some vignettes from my own life into the book is because I think anyone who looked at me early in life would never predict that I would be able to go have the career I did in technology or move on to philanthropy and do some of the things I've had the opportunity to do. So I feel it myself. I mean, anyone can look at himself or herself and say, that's not me. But the real message of the book is that is you, and come join us.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit more about that, because you grew up in some pretty challenging circumstances. Tell us about that and how it's really informed your life.
Sure. Well, I was the youngest child of a single mom. We had four kids in our family, and I was the youngest. So, yeah, we did face some challenges. Perhaps, you know, in some ways, I think it's a very American story. as a recipient of philanthropy myself, I was on a full scholarship at a private school. You know, I was then able to come around and use my own resources to help those who follow behind me. So it's a rare situation in life, I think, where you move from being a recipient of the generosity of others to being in a position in life where then you can share yours with others as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn back to the Case Foundation for a moment and tell us a little bit about the corporate culture. What is unique and distinctive about it, and why is it such a special place in which to work?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe this will help define it a little bit. So when we review where we are with things as part of our annual planning, for instance, we do business plans, but we use this green, yellow, red light theory. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind it is, okay, we're looking at, did we bring to it what we needed to? Did the partner bring to it what they needed to do? And if it's green, it's like, oh yeah, we're off to the races. If it's yellow, it's like, whoa, we better watch that one. And red usually means it's failing. And one year when we did the review, I noticed there were no reds. And so we had a heart-to-heart as a team and said, look, if we really are trying to push the envelope, if we really are trying to bring innovation, we have to have some reds because nobody bats 1,000. And so now we try to make sure that there's always a few things in our portfolio where we're never really sure how they're going to turn out, but we're aiming for something big. And I think in many ways that's a good definition of the culture that we have. And I've been so fortunate. I have this extraordinary team of people who inspire me every day. And I think they're very entrepreneurial in their approach. And we have a lot of fun in the process as well.
That sounds good. Yeah, you're right. If you don't have enough reds or any reds, it means you're not taking enough chances.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. You and your husband became part of the Giving Pledge, I think it was back in 2011. And it's grown into this community of sorts where you all learn from each other. Share with us what it's like to have been part of this distinguished group.
Sure. Well, I must say our commitment to give away the majority of our resources, that commitment was made long before there was a Giving Pledge. It was a little uncomfortable for us to think about being so public with the Giving Pledge when we joined. But ultimately, I think what put us over the line to yes was this really unique opportunity to learn with and from others. So it is really a network of people who are doing exactly what we're trying to do, which is figure out the smartest ways to use your resources to empower others. And it's been a powerful teaching tool for us.
Let me close with this, Jean. What has the impact of philanthropy been on your own life? How has it changed you, and how has it made you the person that you have become?
Well, I would say anything that I am or any opportunities I've had, I have someone else to thank for that. Their time, their resources, their mentoring, their care. Anyone can be a philanthropist. Anyone can make a difference in this world. The reason I wrote the book is to make that crystal clear. There are stories that, as I said earlier, I think anyone will see some of himself or herself in. And, you know, that's what philanthropy has done for me. I wake up every day grateful for the opportunity to work on some really daunting challenges across the world. But it's also some of the most fun I've ever had in my life. So I encourage everyone to jump in.
Yeah, well, you do make it fun. I do know that. And your North Star has always been empowering others. And that's what this book is going to do.
So. Thank you, Denver.
Well, Jean Case, the CEO of the Case Foundation and the author of Be Fearless, 5 Principles for a Life of Breakthroughs and Purpose. I want to thank you so much for being on the show this evening. If people want to get a peek of some of what's included in that book, you share a lot of that online. Where can people go to find it?
ReadBeFearless.com. It's a great place to see a summary of the book, to see what others are saying about it, and to order the book.
Well, this is the perfect book to read if you really want to get 2019 off on the right foot. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show, Jean.
Thank you so much, Denver. Pleasure to be with you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to CharityNavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. CharityNavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
It is said that the best form of charity is to give someone a job. Unfortunately, it is more often said than actually executed. But a young organization that has brought those words to life is the Adventure Project, and it's a pleasure to have with us tonight their co-founder and CEO, Becky Straw. Good evening, Becky, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening. It's so awesome to be here.
Tell us what the Adventure Project does and the mission of the organization.
Absolutely. So we are a nonprofit organization, and we are adding venture capital to create jobs in developing countries. So what that means is that we're focused on helping giving people who live on less than $2 a day job training so that they can move themselves out of poverty. The key is that the job training is around helping the community. So that's everything from training people to be well mechanics or healthcare workers or helping farmers gain access to irrigation. It's what are those smart interventions that's going to lift that family out of poverty so that they can thrive.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, you know, I believe you can learn a lot about an organization by understanding their founding story. So tell us yours, how you connected with your co-founder, Jody Landers, and how the Adventure Project came to be.
Yes. Well, I met my co-founder in an unconventional way. We met in the back of a truck in Liberia, and she is an incredible woman and mom, and she is actually a mom to six children, which is incredible in itself. And she had a great blog that she was running, and I think she was so popular because she's, A, a great writer, but B, like, how many people have six kids and can make that all work? And she, you know, she was from a small town in Iowa, and her husband heard about these two twins in Sierra Leone that needed a family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jody's the type of person who said, well, I already have four kids. Like, what's two more? Which, as a parent, who actually says that? But she did. And so, you know, with that, they decided that they wanted to be globally minded. And so she started raising money for an organization I used to be part of called Charity Water. Mm-hmm. And so I was a program director managing water projects there, and I met her in Liberia to show her all the good that came from her work. And during that time together, we became fast friends, but also connected over the shared belief that we're both not wealthy people, but we want to give well. And we want to know that the money we give is going to the right places and it's truly helping people. It's not about getting our name on a wall of a building. It's about just knowing that we empowered families to raise healthy children. So that's what started this adventure, so
this
to speak.
Adventure, yeah,
not
absolutely.
To be cliche.
You know, it's funny. I was at an event the other night with a guy who was one of 10 children, and he had six kids. And his father was giving him a hassle that he only had six kids, but he told his dad that six is the new 12.
The double inside, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, was there a decision as to whether you were going to become a nonprofit organization as opposed to a social enterprise?
Yes, we thought about it for a while, and I think for us, especially because we tend to talk a lot to moms and millennials and people who give. Our average donation size is about $150. Mm-hmm. So having a tax benefit is helpful to those families. And so we felt being a nonprofit that actually focuses on job creation is kind of a cool, different approach. And we actually couldn't find many organizations that were targeting a movement of people to get involved and learn about these issues and know that their money is going to a good place. So we wanted to be the charity that does things differently.
Mm-hmm. And you're the charity that is looking to create jobs. Was there an aha moment for you where the centrality of a job to the well-being of an individual and their family really hit home?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was working in the water space, I was spending about a third of my time in sub-Saharan Africa and just traveling, finding different water partners, working with them. And, you know, there were several moments. I would say it got to the point where in every country I went to, there'd be one mom or dad that would come up to me and say, hey, thank you so much for this well, but, you know, I'm wondering if you're hiring. And that would be heartbreaking for me because at the time I was in my 20s, I was so young, and to see someone asking so earnestly about their need to take care of their family, or if I can get a job like this, then I can send my kids to school. And that really struck me. And then, you know, it was further enhanced when we started work. The first project we did was in Haiti.
Yeah.
And we were looking, it was right after the earthquake. So we were in one of the largest tent camps outside of Port-au-Prince, you know, and these three huge burly men came up to us. And we had heard rumors, you know, people are starting to get restless. People are getting really frustrated. It's been a year since the earthquake. And so these men approached us, and I was like, oh, shoot, you know, we didn't come with any – we're just assessing. We don't have any food. We weren't dropping off any supplies. And they were so sweet, and they looked at me and just said, ma'am, we're just wondering if you're hiring.
Wow.
and we really need a job. And, you know, for me, that was recognition that I was like, okay, we are about to launch something incredible because this is exactly what people want. And this is why organizations exist, is we need to be thinking about providing tools and services to people, giving them what they want, not what we think they need.
Nothing like that moment of validation, is there?
No.
Well, the organization focuses on four big issues that impact people living in poverty. They would be the environment, health, hunger, and water. That's a pretty broad canvas, having your foot in each one of those camps. Did you ever think of focusing on one or two of them, and why did you decide on all four?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we did. We thought about, for example, we're in the fuel-efficient stove space, right? And that's a space that most people aren't aware of. You know, one of the largest killers of women and children is actually from breathing in toxic smoke while they prepare meals over open fires. So we thought, well, that's an area that doesn't have a lot of awareness. Maybe we can focus there. But when we took a step back, we realized there were so many issue areas that needed good jobs. And if you really want to help local communities thrive, how cool is it to provide, you know, water, healthcare, you know, access to farming and better food, and also, you know, fuel-efficient stoves.
Yeah,
and so taking a holistic approach in terms of providing things that are going to save children's lives, primarily children under 5 years old, and giving those interventions to communities would be really impactful. The second reason being, at the time, we didn't find a lot of incredible organizations that were implementing this approach in this way, where local organizations are creating jobs focused on sustainable impact. And so we felt that it was best to find the best of the best organizations. And that meant going outside just one focus area, but really broadening our approach.
Yeah, yeah. And in some ways, you're really only doing one thing, and that's jobs.
It's jobs.
That's the thread that really connects all these together. Well, let's take one of the areas in which you work, which is water.
Mm-hmm.
What is a big issue in the developing world around water, and what is the Adventure Project doing to address that issue?
Yes, I think incredible organizations like Charity Water, which is the organization I used to be part of, which I was blessed to be part of, are really doing an incredible job raising awareness for the need for clean water and the problem surrounding so many people in, you know, over 600 million people that don't have access to clean water. I think what Americans or most people don't realize is that 36% of all wells in Africa are actually broken.
Yeah.
So what you have is you have incredible intentions going abroad to help people in need, but you don't have people thinking long term about the supply chain, the sustainability, having the right tools and spare parts to keep those wells working. And so that's where we felt that we could come in and provide value, is how could we be an organization providing the funding and support to build these businesses. So we have been supporting Water for People in Uganda that is providing a well mechanic training program where people are learning the skills and they get the tools and spare parts to be maintaining wells in their communities, which is going really well. And in fact, it's looking like the sub-county will be one of the first sub-counties in sub-Saharan Africa to give 100% of the population clean water.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder if it's worse never to have had clean water than to have had it and then have it taken away when the well goes down. That's got to be incredibly frustrating.
And that was my guilt, right? It's because I was going back and visiting communities after giving them clean water and seeing that there was many the failure rate was pretty heartbreaking. Right. And people, you see kids going back to the stream or the river and they're standing, you know, there's three wells that were built in their community and all are now dysfunctional, you know, or communities have tried to fix it on their own, you know, and that's really heartbreaking. So,
yeah, a real key to your business model that you were just sort of alluding to a moment ago does have to do with those local partners.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a pretty lean organization yourself. So how do you identify them and check them out and make sure that they're going to be the right partner for you?
Yeah. So I came from the program development space. So as I said, I spent a third of my time working in sub-Saharan Africa. So that was kind of my big focus area was we need to find incredible partners. And so we're very careful. And, you know, we've only selected 6 organizations that fit our criteria so far. And so we vet every partner before we visit. I think that's a huge benefit. We go out and evaluate almost every year every partner to just make sure everyone's on track and that we really develop a strong relationship. And what we're looking for is very specific. You know, we're looking for organizations that provide a product market fit, meaning they're providing a service that community members are willing to pay for, which I think is very important. There's so many organizations that go out and pass out stuff and say, well, everybody wanted it because everyone took it. Yeah. It doesn't mean that they would have bought it.
I take everything on the street, too.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And so, also that can kill the businesses in the community when charities are doing that.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, perfect stories in Haiti. We were helping start a fuel-efficient stove, clean cook stove enterprise, training, you know, mainly men were making them out of local materials. Women were selling them in Port-au-Prince. And then a large U.S. organization came in 2 years after the earthquake and passed out 10,000 free stoves that they imported from China or India.
Yeah.
And it decimated the sales.
One business after another.
Decimated the sales for over 6 months for those women. And I think we often don't think about the consequences of our charitable giving. And we don't think holistically or bother to work with other organizations to assess the true needs of those communities and how can we be of most help.
Your organization is very focused on data. You love to see the needle move, albeit slowly. And you employ that data to inform your decision making. What data have you collected that you find to be really noteworthy?
Yeah, I think with two things. The coolest things are, you know, we track every entrepreneur and we do a lot of assessment and we're deploying a mobile app so that people can collect the data on Android phones. Once they get to a Wi-Fi hotspot, the data's cached, and once it gets to a hotspot, it gets sent to the back end, which is great. What we're finding is that once an entrepreneur is working, they're spending the money on two things, more food for their families, which is incredible, and then two, to send a kid to school for the first time. So we know that, you know, we've created 1,600 jobs, a little over that. And
what countries?
In Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Haiti, and India, and now Malawi. We just expanded. And we know that over 1,100 children have gone to school for the first time. That is not because we've provided any sort of scholarship or tuition. It's because those parents finally have enough money to be able to buy uniforms, buy the school fee, you know, afford the school fees and the materials. So that's what's really a measurement that we love tracking.
It's sustainable.
It's sustainable.
Absolutely. That's right. You've done good work, and absolutely, they can take it from there. Who are some of your partners in this endeavor, and is there a particular demographic that really supports, you know, provides you with your general support?
Yeah. So, as I said, like moms and millennials, people who give on average $150.
Yeah.
Primarily, we're a movement, and we're trying to show people that you don't have to give a lot of money to really transform someone's life. It's not about, you know, oh, I have to be rich or I have to be Jeff Bezos to be able to make an impact. It's like,
was only half as rich as he was.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I still love Jeff Bezos's money. But really trying to showcase that you can make an incredible difference in someone's life. And it's going to go to an incredible place that's going to transform that family, their children, their communities, and it doesn't have to be $1 million donation, right?
Yeah. And your corporate partners?
And so we have various corporate partners, everyone from the Mattel Foundation has given to, you know, women-founded jewelry companies, Catbird, which is an incredibly cool company that supports us. And what we love is actually foundations and corporations come to us with matching gift opportunities, which is actually really a great way to partner. One Day's Wages is an incredible foundation that's given to us the last 5 years. Everything from a $10,000 match to, you know, we've been doing $50,000 matches every year. By combining our resources, you know, we're able to raise $100,000, meaning that we're even more impactful than we would have been if we were working separately, right? So it's really a very smart and incredible way that we can leverage our strengths, where they're putting money up, and then we're telling our community that they have a matching opportunity.
Being a slightly different kind of charity, do you ever find a challenge in trying to fit into some of these giving guidelines?
Oh, absolutely. That is our biggest challenge, is a lot of people are so rigid with their requirements that we're really an outlier. And so that it's definitely been a huge challenge. And, you know, we talk about scale, and we've been working for 8 years, and we've been getting by as a grassroots organization, slowly growing every year. And then, you know, a few months ago, we were blessed to receive $1 million gift from the Pineapple Fund, which came through Bitcoin donations. And so that was a catalytic gift to us that now is giving us the opportunity to grow and provide some capital.
That is fantastic. Well, let's talk a little bit about scaling, because I think so many guests on this show have said that in this field, that is the hardest thing, is to take a great idea and to scale it for greater impact. Any lessons you've learned as your organization continues to grow and evolve?
Yeah, I think it is. It's really challenging, and we're in the thick of it now because, you know, we had this $1 million gift that came that was unexpected. And
well, how did you react to that, by the way? Do you remember how you reacted when you heard about that $1 million gift, which was unexpected?
Not only do I remember, my entire apartment my entire apartment building remembers how I reacted, you know, because I was 8 months pregnant at the time and not sleeping well. And
you didn't give birth that night, did you?
It came close. It was 3 weeks later. And, you know, we had heard about this donor giving away this money, and we had heard that they were going to reach out, and we waited and waited, and we didn't hear back. We applied through the normal channels, and we were like, oh, man, a few months in, we were like, we didn't hear anything. And they're almost done giving out their funds to, you know, 10,000 organizations applied. They've already picked 40. What are we going to do? So we stopped all work and ended up building a microsite that said Dear Pineapple. And it was a whole site devoted to what we would do if they gave us $1 million and chose us as one of their partners.
Well, very creative.
And so then, thanks. So then, you know, I sent a subject line email that just said, we never heard from you, so we may do this, you know, and sent it to them and just said sincerely, like, we would be so honored if you would consider us. 24 hours later, I woke up at 3 in the morning. And the person wrote back and said, hey, Becky, sorry for the delay. I'd love to give you 1M. And then let me, you know, and I woke up. My husband thought I was in labor. And then the next day, we had a note under our door from somebody in the building saying that somebody had woken them up and could they please keep it down?
Who cares?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of kids who are going to be applying to college are probably going to keep that in mind when they haven't heard back from their school of choice.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your corporate culture. You know, it is so important to the well-being and health of an organization. I don't think many people appreciate, though, how vital the early days and years are in establishing that culture. How do you think about that, Becky? And what are some of the things that you've done to create a great workplace culture at the Adventure Project?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I've made a ton of mistakes, right? Because we're a startup and, like, you're bound to make mistakes. And especially was at the early as a third employee at Charity Water. So that was a very quickly growing organization. And so I was able to learn a lot about building a great culture there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, the key takeaways for me has been, like, since I've started my organization, I've had incredible life experiences and incredibly difficult experiences. You know, I lost my mom, but I met my husband and I got married, and I now have a 10-month-old. So I think it's just the experience of living life has really struck me in terms of how do you build a culture where you understand that people come to work every day, but they have a lot of other things going on in the world personally.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you build a culture where you treat people like adults? How do you hire adults? Because you're not there to micromanage them. So I think one of the differences is we have a very flex work environment.
Mm-hmm.
My new chief development officer has 2 small kids. And I actually loved that, because if you want to get something done, give it to somebody who's already busy, because they tend to crank things out really quickly and effectively. And if you're treating people as adults and giving them the respect and freedom to get their jobs done, they're going to do it 100 times better than if you're micromanaging and checking in and clocking in and making sure that they're, you know, they're at their desks groveling away.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think when you trust people, mm-hmm. and that becomes your default, assuming that they're going to do that job, they pay that trust back with a very nice dividend every mm-hmm. single time. And a lot of people don't think that way.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I think another difference is, too, is that we, you know, really focus on outcomes and data. We love data, as I mm-hmm. said. And so one of our board members actually does this Run Like Clockwork business series, and she's an executive coach that has really helped us focus on, okay, we're tracking all of our time. We're seeing how our time is most effective, and then we're going to double down on that. So it's really, if I'm doing a task that isn't bringing in revenue or it isn't a good use of my time, then I need to outsource it, right? Or I need to either find an intern or we need to hire a consultant to get those low-level tasks off our plates so that we can focus on the bigger things.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the bigger things, you've been in this field of international development for about a decade now at UNICEF, before Charity Water, mm-hmm. and now with TAP, as it's called, the mm-hmm. Adventure Project. What's your impression of it? What do you think the field is doing well, and where do you think it stands to improve?
Yeah, I think there's so many needs around the world. I think what is most hopeful and inspiring is that for the first time, less than 10% of the global population lives in extreme poverty.
Right.
Right. So we're doing something right, and people are moving out of poverty faster, which is incredible.
A lot of that is China, of course.
In India, yeah.
But it's still happening, and not many people realize that. They think it's getting worse. And
yeah.
And it is the first time in human history that it's been in single digits.
Exactly. I would argue that that's because of enterprise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because countries are able to develop, and because they're creating jobs, people are moving out of poverty. So that's why we're doubling down on sub-Saharan Africa, is because that's where most of the extreme poor are remaining and need the most funding mm-hmm. to grow. You know, in terms of criticism, I don't know if I'd call it that. I think what I really realized is that there were so many nonprofits that were spending so much time chasing the money, they weren't focused on evaluation. And the perfect example of that is wells, you know, are your wells still working? It's great that you've built a million of them. How many are still working?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter how much money flows through it, you know, if they're not providing people
with clean water. There's no water flowing through if they're not working. That's
yeah.
right. You know,
yeah.
It's a little bit, I think, the way we think about infrastructure in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd rather cut a ribbon and open a new building, but the subways yeah. haven't been, you know, maintained for a century.
Yep. Absolutely.
It's boring. You know, it's grunt work, and we just don't somehow gravitate to it.
Yeah. It's all the unsexy stuff
yeah.
that keeps
the plumbing.
Everything working, right?
Mm-hmm.
And keeps people to get into their jobs every day, right?
Yeah, Let me close with this, Becky. Much of your motivation and energy comes from the inspiring people that you've had the opportunity to meet and encounter through the Adventure Project. Share with us one of those stories, if you would.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, Grace is one that I always think about because I keep visiting her every time I'm in Uganda. But when I first met her, you know, she was recently widowed, and she had three children. And so I asked, she was very lucky in that Living Goods, an incredible healthcare organization, came into her community and was hiring to train women to become healthcare workers.
They're fantastic.
Fantastic. And so she was able to get hired, and it just started. And I asked, you know, her daughter, like, how do you feel now that your mom has to go to work every day? You know, what is it like for you? And she turned it around and said, like, well, now everybody calls my mom the kind one. And I said, like, well, what is it, the kind one? What does that mean? She's like, oh, she's just known as the kind one. And that's how she's referred in the community. And Grace, like, interjected and said, like, oh, well, it's because when I was, you know, first starting out a few weeks ago, a mom came to me crying that her three kids were all sick, but she didn't have any money for medicine or anything. So Grace, you know, ran over with the mom, saw that the kids all had a really bad case of malaria.
Mm-hmm.
And so what, you know, Grace said it was a really big turning point for her because she had just started and she was told, you can't give these drugs away. You need to sell them. That's how you're going to get commission from your sales. But what she said to the mom was like, okay, I'm going to loan you the money and I'm going to loan you these medicines and you can pay me back later. And so when the mom paid her back, she went through the whole village screaming, saying, you know, Grace is the kind one because she saved my children.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty good story to end on. I got to tell you, it really is.
Yeah.
Well, Becky Straw, the Chief Executive Officer of the Adventure Project, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and how listeners can help support this work if they are so inclined.
Oh, I'd love that. It is called theadventureproject.org. And we would love support, whether you're joining our email list or if you really want to get involved, you can join our collective, which is a community of monthly donors who, you know, are committed to creating jobs and empowering other people. And actually, if you, you know, you join soon, we have a special group of donors who are going to donate $250 for every new sign up. So that's like a great way that you can help unlock more money for our organization and, you know, start your new year right with resolving to give back monthly.
You don't give them all their own website, though. No, I'm only kidding. Thanks, no. Becky. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Denver. Appreciate it.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Ellen Agler, the CEO of the N Fund and the author of Under the Big Tree, Extraordinary Stories from the Movement to End Neglected Tropical Diseases. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.